SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandame Ngaya. I am Bertrand Tungandame. Coming up in your program this Monday, the 10th of June, like every Monday afternoon, we bring you current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. We also have a conversation with Chantel Jones, a Marlinja community organizer, as her town in the remote Northern Territory community of Marlinja has become home to Australia's first Indigenous-owned solar energy grid. And staying in the Northern Territory, Yirrkal community leaders are celebrating 50 years since bilingual schools were established in defiance of bipartisan government efforts to dismantle them. All these stories and more coming to you on NITV Radio after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
Bulletin, Gamilaroi Elder Auntie Beryl Van Oplu, Australians from migrant communities, among 737 honoured in King's birthday list. The Federal Coalition says it's committed to the Paris Agreement but will scrap Australian climate targets. And in AFL, Carlton coach Michael Voss says his team deserves their second place spot on the ladder. Gamilaroi Elder Auntie Beryl Van Oplu is one of 737 Australians recognised in this year's King's Birthday Honours list. Auntie Beryl has promoted Indigenous ingredients through her own restaurants and in kitchens around the world, her tireless service being recognised with an OAM. For 50 years, she's taught hospitality and employment skills first at TAFE, then through the Job Ready program she developed in Sydney's Red Fund 18 years ago.
If I see one of them graduate or one of them go on their own journey and have a better quality of life, then I'm doing my job.
Now 81, Auntie Beryl still runs the Yama Bargai Catering Company, working alongside former students.
There was nowhere for us to find employment for our students that we trained. So I set up my own catering company, so I became the employer as well, not to make money, but to give our mob an opportunity to work and then eventually go on their own journey.
A new study has found First Nations people have been caring for sea country for millennia and hold the key for Australia's blue carbon market to realise its full potential. Research from the country's big Indigenous carbon organisation found Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people hold rights over 66% of Australia's coastline, but it suggests they are being locked out of schemes to own and sell carbon in coastal ecosystems. The report from the Indigenous Carbon Industry Network recommends where the Crown has rights to carbon, it should instead go to traditional owners, with the exception of private or Indigenous-owned lands. The Federal Coalition says it's committed to the Paris Agreement but will scrap Australia's own legally binding climate targets. Opposition leader Peter Dutton has said he would dump Australia's 2030 target to cut emissions by 43% from 2005 levels should the Coalition win the next federal election. Under the Paris Agreement, members must increase their emissions targets every 5 years and cannot water them down. Opposition spokesperson for climate change and energy, Ted O'Brien, has told the ABC the government's 2030 target is unachievable.
We are absolutely committed to the Paris Agreement. We are absolutely committed to achieving net zero by 2050, and we will have a plan to do so. What we have done is we've called Labor out. Labor legislated for a 43% emissions reduction cut by 2030. They have Buckley's chance of achieving that. Their own climate change authority in last year's progress report at the end of the year also made that clear.
The federal government has accused the Greens of misrepresenting Australia's involvement in the conflict in Gaza for political advantage. Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy says Australia had no say in the awarding of ADF Australia, ADF subcontract worth $917 million to an Israeli weapons manufacturer. The Greens have repeatedly called for Australia to impose sanctions and end arms trading with Israel over its offensive in Gaza. In the meantime, Hamas military wing says three hostages were killed in an Israeli military operation in which four hostages were freed. An Israeli military spokesperson has dismissed the claim made by Hamas's armed Al-Qassam brigades about the deaths of three unnamed hostages, including a U.S. citizen, in a video posted in its Telegram channel. Israel rescued four hostages held by Hamas in an operation in central Gaza's Al-Nusrayat refugee camp on Saturday, an operation which killed 274 Palestinians. The loss of life in the operation has sparked protests across Australia, with demonstrators calling for the Albanese government to impose sanctions across Israel. Federal Minister for Early Education Anne Ali is to represent Australia at an emergency conference in Jordan to address the humanitarian situation in Gaza alongside world leaders including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. In an interview with SBS News, she has defended Australia's response to the conflict.
We are focused on continuing to call for a ceasefire, continuing to do our bit to provide aid, humanitarian aid, to respond to the devastating crisis, and to working towards a two-state solution as the only pathway to an everlasting and sustainable peace.
Exit polls suggest Eurosceptic nationalists across Europe have made the biggest gains in European Union elections. Populist parties in France, Germany, the Netherlands, Austria and elsewhere performed strongly in a vote that will likely cause the balance of power to shift to the right in the 720-seat parliament. The shift may complicate European Union policymaking and attempts to deepen integration over the next 5 years. But European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, whose centre-right European People's Party appears likely to remain the largest party, said the results were a good day for the bloc.
We are the strongest party. We are the anchor of stability, and voters acknowledged our leadership during the last 5 years, and this is a great message to all of us.
Women in Australia's media industry are reporting record levels of career dissatisfaction due to inequality and a lack of opportunities. The Women in Media's Group's 2024 Industry Insights report had found a dissatisfaction rate of 57% could lead to a mass exodus of women from the industry. The report, which surveyed 129 women working in diverse media roles across Australia, found career dissatisfaction is at a three-year high, with early career women and women with 5 to 10 years of experience making up a significant proportion. 56% of women perceived the industry as being weak on gender equality, with pay equity a significant issue, while half of mid-career women expressed uncertainty over their career advancement, citing a lack of opportunities. And in sport, in AFL, Carlton coach Michael Voss says he's proud of his team after a 96-70 victory over Essendon catapulted them to second on the ladder. The win over traditional rivals, the Bombers, at the MCG on Sunday night comes after fighting through injury woes and a tough draw in the first half of the season. It was their ninth game in 10 weeks against opponents currently in the top 10 positions on the table and fourth win in their last five games. Voss told Fox Sports the Blues deserved their position as second favourites for their year's premiership.
We are where we deserve. The ladder doesn't lie. And we've had to do it with some challenges, so it hasn't been smooth sailing. I mean, we've been facing these top teams week after week after week.
And now having a look at the weather around the country. Broome, sunny, 30. Perth, a shower 2, 21. Adelaide, a possible late shower 20. Melbourne, late shower 2, 15 degrees. Hobart, similar forecast 12. Albury, Wodonga, mostly sunny 13. Canberra, partly cloudy 13. Wollongong, sunny 17. Sydney, mostly sunny 18. Newcastle, much the same 19. Brisbane, sunny 23. Townsville, similar conditions 26. Cairns, mostly sunny 26. Alice Springs, sunny 25, Darwin also sunny 31, and the Torres Strait Islands, a sunny day and a top of 29 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Still to come, we discover with Chantelle Jones, a Malinja community organizer, Australia's first indigenous-owned solar energy grid launched last Thursday on the 6th of June in the remote Northern Territory town of Malinja. And Yirrkala community leaders are celebrating 50 years since bilingual schools were established in the Northern Territory in defiance of bipartisan government efforts to dismantle them. But first, like every Monday afternoon, current affairs stories shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. South Australia's Commissioner for Aboriginal Children has delivered a scathing report into the removal of First Nations children from their parents. The two-year inquiry found South Australia has the second highest rate of Aboriginal children on long-term guardianship orders and the second lowest rate of reunification compared with all other Australian states and territories. Peter Doherty reports.
Commissioner April Laurie says the removal of Aboriginal children from their families in South Australia is approaching levels seen during the stolen generations. Ms Laurie says culturally biased assessment tools were contributing to the removal of children as a first rather than a last resort. The inquiry heard from hundreds of Indigenous children, family and carers.
This deep sense of grief coming from the harm that they experience, that removal is meant to make things better for Aboriginal children and young people, but removal does not yield those things that people expect. Children get disconnected from their families, they get disconnected from their culture, they get disconnected from their community.
The report notes that in South Australia, 1 in 10 Aboriginal children are in state care. 37% of all children in out-of-home care are Aboriginal. And between 2022 and 2023, one-third of all babies removed from hospitals were Aboriginal.
Mothers talked about not only that revolting grief that they experience and the shock, but how the treachery of the department with conducting an uninformed removal, that they were the last to know that there had been a plan in place during their pregnancy that they were unaware of to conduct a removal without their knowledge until the point of delivery.
The report calls for an end to the practice of removing children at birth without consultation. It says family conferencing should be mandatory for all Aboriginal children who come in contact with the system, and it recommends a child's right to culture and family be embedded in legislation.
The family of a First Nations woman whose remains were found at the bottom of a cliff in Brisbane say they'll keep fighting for answers. After a lengthy inquest, Queensland's deputy coroner has ruled Constance Wacho's death was suspicious but was unable to deliver a definitive finding about how she died. Danny Rennie has more.
Mother of 10, Constance Wacho, was last seen walking with her partner in the Brisbane suburb of Kangaroo Point in 2017. The 36-year-old's remains were discovered in and around a sports bag at the bottom of a cliff about 10 months later, long after her family reported her missing.
This can't continue. Aboriginal women disappearing and being murdered and not having justice in this country.
Emerging from court, the family says they're devastated after the deputy state coroner was unable to find a cause of Miss Wacho's death, despite declaring it suspicious.
It was heartbreaking for everybody today, and it's going to be heartbreaking for us until we have closure.
The coroner ruled that, based on the state of decomposition of Constance's remains, what caused Constance's death may never be known. Miss Wacho's former partner and a man who was staying with the couple at their unit in Kangaroo Point gave evidence at the inquest, but denied any involvement in her death. The deputy coroner found, "I am unable to identify any person as a person who was involved." She urged police to continue to investigate the case while the family have called on police to meet with them.
We need to know what's going on. We need to sit down with them. The family needs to know. This has gone on for too long.
Dan Rennie, NITV News.
A tiny beach shack on a remote island in the Torres Strait has become one of the world's most desired tourist destinations. After making it onto the Forbes Top 50 Places to Visit, Badu Island has put the region on the global tourism map. Traditional owners says the venture is helping them care for country and grow their island economy. Carly Willis reports.
With its stunning sunsets and pristine beaches, this island paradise has caught the world's attention, a bucket list destination of rare beauty and power.
So they sit around the fire and just like an ocean sound, just like connect and share their thoughts. Some of them, like, they cry, and I know why they cry because sometimes I do that too.
Affectionately named Ulup Healing, this simple beach shack is listed as one of the top 50 places in the world to visit by Forbes magazine.
I thought it was a scam, that email, but then I seen that it CC'd some people and I was like, no, this is real. So, yeah, I had another read. I cried.
The bounty of the sea freshly harvested. Ancient recipes making up the menu and back-to-basics bedrooms, all part of this unique tourism sensation.
This is a vitally important part of our potential tourism industry. There is huge potential here in the Torres Strait. But what I also know is that tourism provides the foundation stones for strengthening culture, but more importantly, it also provides the foundation stones for wealth creation.
Its founder and traditional owner is deeply connected to this place. Booked out a year in advance, visitor numbers are strictly limited to ensure the integrity of the area and the experience.
Because Ulup is on ancestral grounds, it's a culture site surrounded by culture sites, and when I do have clientele, I always respect the ground that we walk on.
With few jobs on the island, there's hope ventures like this could turn things around.
I think there's a lot to offer. There's a lot of opportunity and there's a big potential.
Sharing with the world to keep culture strong. Carly Willis, NITV News.
Wildflower gardens are widely planted in European cities for their beauty and biodiversity benefits. And now, more Australian companies and councils are cultivating the gardens in urban areas. As NITV's Emma Calloway reports, this is good news for a Sydney-based First Nations entrepreneur.
Winter work is underway at an inner-city cultural garden. Caring for these native plants is a focus for First Nations businessman Roman Deguchi and his team.
A place like this really highlights the sort of special, unique and beauty of Indigenous plants.
This native garden may be small, but it's brimming with biodiversity.
This is a lily pili. A little bit like an apple.
A lot of bush foods, a lot of nitrogen sort of fixes, a lot of established trees that were here originally, like the lemon-scented gums, a few different species of wattles.
Roman grew up around Sydney's red fern and later trained in horticulture.
Different little native flowers.
Since setting up this business 3 years ago, he's hired 20 local workers.
Because I'm Aboriginal myself, being from Redfern and Waterloo, being able to come here and have a job, full-time job, you know, it's something special.
It makes me very proud to bring back all these native gardens in these certain areas where they're supposed to be.
Sharing knowledge of native plants is also part of its purpose.
Guy Mee Lily, an iconic local plant. When it's flowering, it's well season, and you know wells are migrating. So every plant, there's a story to be told.
Roman says working with native species has also strengthened his own cultural connections.
I've come from stolen generations, so my grandfather was taken as a baby. I actually fell into landscaping and horticulture just indirectly. It's a real turning point for me because not knowing a lot about identity and culture, that helped me understand myself.
Planting wildflowers is a growing trend in Australia, on farms, in cities, and even on former industrial sites.
Using native species in urban landscapes can really increase our connection to country. But there's also an increasing body of research which shows that exposure to nature in this regard can really be restorative to people's mental health.
It's hoped by cultivating more wildflower gardens, respect will grow for Australia's natural bushland and its bounty.
The ultimate dream for us is that this is a model that we've created that can be translated across Australia. A place like this is a source of pride, a place that reconciliation can happen. When the wider mainstream Australia start recognising the beauty and the knowledge that exists in Aboriginal culture and history.
Emma Kellaway, NITV News.
And that's all from stories shared with us by NITV's NALA program, a current affairs program focusing on current affairs from a First Nations perspective. We must now go to a break, but stay with us because when we come back, we have a story about Australia's first Indigenous-owned solar energy grid.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Now, on Thursday, the 6th of June, history was made when the Malinja community in the Northern Territory launched Australia's first First Nations community-owned renewable energy project, a solar microgrid. Chantel Jones, a Malinja community project organizer who was instrumental in supporting residents in the design and development of the project, says it is hoped the microgrid will offer the Northern Territory government and other First Nations communities around Australia an inspiring blueprint for community-owned energy that supports a faster and fairer transition to renewable energy for everyone. On the sidelines of the launch ceremony, I caught up with Chantel Jones. She said that in championing the project, she was most concerned about the lack of affordability of prepaid power cards for Malinja residents and also supply-side disconnections affecting the entire community. She also said the launch of the solar-powered microgrid is the fruition of 5 years of hard work.
This project alone has been about 5 years in the making. But before the microgrid, before this project, we actually initially started off with our community centre, doing rooftop solar on our community centre. And from there, we built on, because obviously with the community members and staff that were involved in the rooftop solar at our community centre, we all very much quickly realised how beneficial solar can be to remote communities. And that's when we started the long journey of going through all the approvals and, you know, having to weave our way through, you know, policies and regulations and all that sort of stuff to have this project that we're launching today. But yeah, that was how it originally started, from the connections that the community members made through fracking and protesting against gas. That was when they made the connections with clean energy people and were able to invite them into the community. We started with our community centre, and then from 2019, we've been doing all the background work for this now microgrid that we're launching today. It's been a long journey.
Yeah, it's been a long journey, but there also has been, I believe, some hurdles to overcome because you have to get authorizations and, well, the whole country. There are thousands and thousands of solar panels on rooftops, but in communities like Malinja or other communities in the Baitalu Basin, residents accessing this kind of infrastructure is not easy because they have to go through different regulations.
The current project that we're launching today is actually our plan B. So our plan A was we all wanted a rooftop solar on all the houses here. But due to where Mullinger's under social housing, so there weren't any policies or regulations or anything in place that could support that. So our first initial idea of rooftop solar for all the houses actually couldn't happen because of that. So to me, that just very much states that social housing and things like that are very far behind. They're not, sort of up with it these days, pretty much. So hence why we had to go the microgrid route. Now, the microgrid route is obviously, it's about 10 times more expensive and all them sort of things, and took a lot longer, but we had to get different sort of permissions and things like that to have the microgrid project. It was it's slightly different to then rooftop. But yeah, we did originally want rooftop, but because of regulations and policies and things like that that are in place, that just wasn't able to happen in community.
So there's the funding side, which is really one of the biggest hurdle to overcome. And you just mentioned, some legal requirements and the typical type of housing in the area. How was the journey and how did you manage to bring together all the different stakeholders in this really groundbreaking project?
It has been a pretty tough journey, actually. I mean, I'm very grateful and thankful for my team at Original Power. They powered on through all of that and pushed through all the regulatory stuff that they needed to get through. But as a community aspect for myself, for my position in Original Power, there was still a lot of stuff the community needed to do for like meeting together and making sure that we weren't going to compromise sacred sites. You know, we had to do letters from traditional owners and stuff to say that that's all good. So that all those little steps and stuff also coincide for approvals with things such as like Northern Land Council, Power and Water, you know, all them sort of organizations and stuff that are, and stakeholders and everything that have been involved. There's been lots of little steps that we've had to do extra to basically provide all of that to all of these companies, so everyone's crossing their T's and dotting their I's sort of thing. Because it is the first of its kind, we've definitely had to make sure that we've had everything in place, all the right permissions. But mainly where I come in is making sure that there's the right permissions and everything in place when it comes to the liaisoning with the traditional owners as well for all of that too.
And has it been easy to actually get some of the approvals? I can think of one is the amount of power that can be put back into the grid and regulations around that are very strict. How do you navigate
Our panels will be producing 100 kilowatts of power and our battery will be producing 136 kilowatts of power. Yeah, all of that was all done through my boss, Laura Miller, who's part of Original Power, and her team. That was a lot of the background work and stuff, and the electricians, and you know, all everyone that was involved. That was all collectively done with them. But as for the community side of things, making sure the permission and everything was all okay with the community and the traditional owners, that side was actually quite easy because the community wants it. You know, they want it to happen and everything, so they made sure that it was in the best possible place. Everyone agreed to it. So the community side of things was actually the easiest in the whole process. It would have been good if Lauren could have joined us today, but unfortunately, yeah, she's a bit busy. But they did deal with all the background stuff and getting those permissions and everything. So 5 years took a long time to get all that through.
Yeah. And one of the biggest complaints and really biggest actually disturbing situation in the area is that residents have to prepay their electricity, and there has been dramatic situations where people have their electricity card. How will this project alleviate this situation, and how much power, what's the percentage of the power supply that is going to be able to contribute to?
Yeah, so the community is currently on the prepaid meter system. Now, we are not taking that system out at all. We are still keeping that system. That will be basically a backup, you might as well say. So we're still going to keep that prepaid system. And the solar that is produced from this microgrid will direct credit our current prepaid meters. So that's initially in itself, that's also the first of its kind. Nobody's ever done that before. So having to do that and sort that out, it was one step alone. But yes, community are on prepaid meters. Currently at the moment, in our peak build-up and hot weather times, some families could be spending anywhere from $50 a day to $250 a week just on power, you know, to keep air conditioners running, fridges, you know, fans and everything. Because that also goes back to another problem that, you know, the social housing was never built to the standard that needs to be here. So, you know, the houses don't have correct insulation, you know, and all them sort of things. So, and ideally with this project, it's going to eliminate the cost of that power to allow families to either save money if they want, or we all know the cost of living is absolutely astronomical at the moment. So it could allow family to have a bit more money to spend on food, you know, and things like that, you know, or save up so they can replace their old appliances with new, more better energy efficient appliances and all that sort of thing. So ideally it's to give us almost free power, but we do still have our prepaid meters as backup. So obviously the community still has a lot of work to do, like changing habit as well and learning the best way to use power when we flick the switch sort of thing over to solar. So there is still some background work to be done, but we do have our prepaid system as backup as well.
So you're not.
So yeah, the community shouldn't black out anymore. We shouldn't have big blackouts anymore. Like, I mean, we can black out from 5 minutes to 5 days power, you know, where we lose all our food, our elders lose all their medication, you know, kids can't have showers to go to school, you know, all that sort of thing. So this project is going to eliminate that over time. So it will take family and things a little bit to get used to, you know, the different types of power and how they can use it and stuff. But once everyone gets used to this new power and how it works and everything, it should help to eliminate all the blackout, all the, you know, family don't have to sleep outside, cook outside and all those sort of things. So it's definitely going to help with a lot of issues that the community face.
Most definitely. And the launch is being described as almost as a festival kind of event with
almost. We're very, very busy today. Our launch kicks off at 4 o'clock today. So we've got stages being set up for bands and catering and all sort, but it's the whole community that's actually putting everything together.
And before I let you go, any closing thoughts?
Yeah, look, I honestly just want to say a massive thank you to not only all the community members in Mullinger for pulling together and coming together and working to make this happen, but I also do want to say a massive thank you to Original Power, 5B, Bush Grid, Regional Deal, everyone that was involved in helping Mullinger community make this happen. I know everyone here is extremely proud and can't wait for tonight to happen. So just, yeah, a massive, massive thank you to everyone that's been involved. It will probably take me too long to name everyone individually, but they all know who they are. We are so appreciative of them. And yeah, just couldn't thank them enough.
And just to mention, this conversation was recorded on Thursday, the 6th of June, on the sidelines of the launch of Mullinger's solar-powered microgrid. And that was Chantelle Jones, a community organizer who was instrumental in supporting residents in the design and development of this power grid, which is Australia's first First Nations community-owned solar-powered microgrid. What a great achievement. And this full interview is published on our website. We must now step aside for another break, but stay with us, because when we come back, the Yirrkala community in the Northern Territory will be celebrating half a century since bilingual schools were established, despite bipartisan government attempts to dismantle the system.
Visit sbs.com.au/NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now, from rogue educators to leaders in remote education, Yirrkala community leaders in the Northern Territory are celebrating 50 years of bilingual education at the local government school, where elders and teachers defied government orders to dismantle the two-way education system. Alan Lee reports.
A traditional ceremony to celebrate a hard-won victory in the remote government school in Yirrkala. Karen Weston is the Chief Executive of the Northern Territory's Education Department.
We're really keen to continue to support you to do whatever we can to promote the amazing work that happens at this school.
Painted and proud, students here learn the curriculum in more than a dozen traditional languages, supported by Yolngu and non-Indigenous teachers. Yalmay Yunupingu is the chair of the Yirrkala School Board and 2024's Senior Australian of the Year.
Yolngu Mata is their first language, and English is their second language. And this is what they're comfortable in when they're in the classroom.
It's been half a century since bilingual schools were established in the Northern Territory under the Commonwealth. The Territory achieved self-government in 1978, and since then both major parties have tried to dismantle the system. They've been met with unwavering defiance from Yolngu elders and teachers. Co-principal of the Yirrkala School, Merikiyawai Gunambar Stubbs, says it's a process that has taken perseverance.
We heard about it, but we just kept doing what we thought was appropriate for this school.
Yalma Yunupingu further describes the importance of language.
We don't want the language to lose. Because language is very important because it talks about our identity, who we are, where we come from. And we can't take that away.
The bravery to stand up for bilingual education now has government support. Mark Monaghan is the NT's education minister.
These people not only represented this region and fought for bilingual education, and it wasn't an easy fight. It wasn't an easy fight, but they fought not just for here, but they fought for every other region in the Northern Territory and across the country.
The local member for this electorate of Mulka, Mark Yingia Guyula, says he is a product of the bilingual education in nearby Gullawinku and took these principles of respect to Parliament House.
The first thing I walked into Parliament House, I spoke Yolngu Mata, and they said, no. You can't say that. Then I pushed. Wait, I want to speak Yolngu Mata. And I got told, we can't. Then I pushed. I pushed three times, and finally they said, you can use Yolngu Mata in Parliament. So it's there.
The next step is getting better recognition for the Yolngu teachers leading these classrooms. Co-principal of the Yirrkala School, Katrina Hudson, explains.
Every single one of our Yolngu staff is involved in training, and that also has been a battle to keep that going through different funding cycles, and it's something that we still are working towards, and I guess having greater advocacy for tertiary institutions to recognise Yolngu who are working already as teachers in classrooms and trying to tailor courses to being language specialists, Indigenous language specialists.
The Department of Education wants to grow more teachers in remote communities too. They're bringing back the programs that nurtured teachers like Senior Australian of the Year, Professor Yalma Yunupingu, with further announcements expected in the near future. Alan Lee, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
That's all we have time for on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. Your program will be back with more news and stories from right across the country later this week on Wednesday and Friday. I am Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu. People's movement.